phone.
Very inspiring.
There we go. Which Phipps thing? There were like
there were a few things.
I can't talk. Like I said, I'm highly medicated, so this will be all over the place. I also took a bunch of painkillers and muscle relaxants.
Nice. Unlike our usual conversations that are so on topic.
Yeah, no sidebars, no sidetracking ever.
Yeah. The Phipps thing that I don't know. Ooh, you okay?
Yeah,
I found
I'm on drugs.
there were a bunch of things. But the one that I found the most hopeful was just the 3D map, like the world map.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't expect to see that many nodes.
Yeah.
That was very surprising. Yeah. That was very, very surprising.
Yeah, I was surprised too. Someone mentioned that's probably because of Marty Malmy's NostraVPN, which basically automatically spins up a Phipps node or something like that as well, or is Phipps reachable. And a bunch of people use the VPN.
Yeah.
But it was awesome to see,
even if that's the case,
how many there are and how distributed it is.
Yeah.
Like, it was all over the place, except China.
Well, maybe, you know, geolocated. It's also like Japanese relays that just block us.
I think we have one Chinese Phipps node, and it's...
fresh, 24 hours old.
100% of women participants at Sovereign Engineering run a Phipps node in China.
Men, keep up.
Yeah. When you look at that.
Yeah.
See? It's an omen.
Pirate 100%.
Ship, almost wireless, the other thing.
Probably running a few Phipps nodes in there.
Yeah. Who knows? There was a Phipps node on the pirate ship. Like, I remember Chandran doing some tests.
Of course, Felix.
With antennas and things and so on. Yeah, it's amazing that it's a thing and it's still going, and it's actually a thing now.
Like, yeah.
Like, 3 quarters ago, it was just an idea. And now, like, there's so much stuff happening. People are building on it, and it actually works. Zaza showed off Archipelago and the Phipps Connection Archipelago.
Yeah.
And one thing that was amazing that he showed was, like, it made everything faster.
Yeah, that's why I was so intrigued, because I've been going down this rabbit hole of strictness on interfaces, not like UI interfaces, but like programming interfaces and protocols and whatnot. Lead to identifying, that's what Rust, you know, like, why people like go to Rust so much. The strictness of the thing reveals a bunch of issues before they become issues, whereas something more malleable will accept it, you know, will accept something inferior, something that's subpar. And I was very interested to see. That's why I asked the follow-up, because one of the agents that did the thing said, implementing Phipps, what was it that the agent, like, the quote that he put?
Phipps made our sins obvious, that.
There you go.
And so they had to, a bunch of things had to be fixed and done in a cleaner way so that it works over Phipps, and that's what made everything faster.
And I find that so interesting. I wanted to understand the mechanics, like, exactly what were the sins that were being accepted, you know, by something more more malleable, like a protocol more malleable.
Yeah, it's a shame you can't plug into the session and ask yourself, right?
Yeah, that would be nice.
Soon.
I think we're going to talk about that a bit. I still have so many questions. We did the workshop. Was it the workshop? No, on Tuesday we did the talk on Phipps, and I kept barraging with questions.
Yeah.
Because I'm new to Phipps, and
I'm new to Phipps. I'm here to fix it. Yeah. you fix? What's the main issue you have with Phipps?
The root node, I understand it doesn't, like, you know, like, it doesn't...
Doesn't have influence.
Doesn't have influence and all that. even though the root node itself doesn't have more power or anything within the network, I think the concept of the root node packs a lot of like they needed to introduce rate limiting because of root nodes, right?
That, yeah.
And the fact that you're introducing a rate limit means that there is a problem and you're patching the design, which might be, you know, it might be how you need to solve it. It might be that is the right solution. But the moment you're doing rate limits is because there isn't a cleaner solution to the problem. And now you need to protect the problem.
I see.
And I think there are a lot of, opens a lot of vectors of attack. That's why, so one of my demos from yesterday was did you ever use the Polar Liquid Network?
Yeah, I played around with it just to, you know, like build up the simulations, those kind of things.
Yeah, so I like that project a lot because it you know, it kind of allows you to play with different points of the, like you can simulate a very complex environment, a very adversarial environment and shit like that. And I wanted to do the same thing for FIPS. So that was one of my demos from yesterday. And the whole idea was I want to be able to, with an agent that understands FIPS very, very well and understands all the existing fixtures and all the existing stress tests of the concept of FIPS, that can simulate scenarios and I can like direct it to poke on the different scenarios, you know, like let's spin up one node that will become the root and one new node every whatever 5 seconds attaches to that one node and that new node becomes the root constantly.
So what
happens there, you know, like all these different scenarios.
Yeah. But because you have to mine the NPUP, it also gets harder over time, this attack, right? Introducing yourself as a new node, unless, I mean, you can connect and disconnect and those kind of things. You can do a bunch of things.
That's the other thing, even if you are not the root node, just your presence requires your path key being distributed through the network.
And I think that was the point that Arian tried to make, that even if it's the root node, you don't disrupt the whole network. You like, because you care mostly about what's around you. Let's say you're on the most right-hand side of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happens there, you know?
Yeah.
And so you don't even realize that something is reorganizing way above you. And same for, like, if you're way high up, if something reorganizes, like if a new leaf attaches, you don't even need
to know. But if you're connected, if it's the same FIPS network, and you need to assess this path key might be the root, right? And then you need to distribute the path key itself throughout the entire thing. I mean, I guess you could, I don't know if they already
no, you
do
don't.
This because you don't
you
propagate
don't. You don't.
Unless...
You absolutely don't. You don't. You need to update the bloom filters, but it's just about building up a hierarchy, and it's about the nodes around you. Like, what's the next one? Where does the... It's all about directionality. Does it need to go up or down?
Right.
And so if you have a parent already and the new node is way above that parent, like, you don't care about this one.
But you don't see the pub key.
But you don't need to. It's like, it's always about next hop. Like, where does the traffic need to flow, up or down?
But how do you see the, how do you know in which direction if you haven't updated your bloom filters because you haven't seen the pub key? Like, you haven't seen, you don't know that there is this new node and that your route to this new node is in this direction. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I'm... Yeah,
This is kind of why I made like this thing, so to be able to simulate all these things and then ask.
The simulator will tell us.
Yeah. The agents will figure it out.
Yeah, it's, I think, also something that Jonathan mentioned in some sense, like, it's not meant and can't be the solution to absolutely every scenario.
Yeah.
And it will never be perfect and kind of, you know, will patch the issues that we run into as we run into them as the network scales.
That's kind of another thing that inspires me a lot about the concept of FIPS, is that if you try to make it like a replacement for the whole internet,
yeah,
like everything runs on, it's like one FIPS network.
Yeah,
it like work. It makes no sense. Yeah. It breaks. So in that way, it's exactly the same concept as NOFTA. It is literally the same.
It leans into locality, and you want to try to build up small local
networks.
It is
so much better. It's much better suited for the local problem, and just meshing organically.
Yeah.
Than to be like this monster one big thing,
yeah.
Which is, yeah, again, it is the same concept of Nostr. And I think it's one of, like, from a spiritual standpoint, is one of the most interesting things, yeah, that is behind the, like, yeah, this concept of local first and Nostr.
And it's something that takes a while to get used to, and I feel like a lot of people still have a hard time wrapping their head around, you know, there is no global.
Yeah.
First episode, I think.
Yeah,
you know, there's no goals.
It was,
And here we are, you know, like years later now, many months later, and there's still people that try to build Nostr apps with a global view and just can't really accept the fact that it's an anti-pattern, basically.
Yeah. In the Nostr world. You're fighting the. You're fighting the protocol, you're fighting the design.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with MLS and encryption, right?
Yeah.
It's the environment is fighting what you're trying to do.
Yeah. And I think what we saw on Tuesday with the Tuesday talks, what Dimitri presented, it was like the culmination of anti-patterns in the sense of
all of them
trying to build a really big app, like an everything app, you know, like Musk tries to do,
yeah,
or like the WeChat and so on, the Chinese, yeah, apps, like every single vertical, build all of that out, and Nostr just has no place at all with this. It doesn't help you at all. And by design, the thing needs a global view,
mm-hmm,
and needs, you know, like, it is a centrally controlled system. I mean, and that's the point of WeChat, that's the point 100%. Of the everything app that Musk wants to build.
But it's interesting how pretty much every single attempt that has been made of building something like that on Nostr has fallen for almost 100% union, intersection, the same faults of, well, the NSEC is kind of scary, so we're going to keep it from you,
and
you're not going to see anything.
Yeah.
And actually, if I publish my my users, which always irks me, the idea of my users, not people, not people that use this app right now, or some other app, then
it's like my prisoners.
My prisoners.
Those are my inmates.
Exactly.
Those are my inmates.
And that's it comes up every single time, how they always err on the side of, oh, it's too soon to publish their data on Nostr, so I'm going to grab data from Nostr, and I'm just going to serve it into my database, because that way it's also faster, you know, it's more reliable, and I can, you know, like, do these algorithms and sort these things. And every single time, it's the exact same mindset, which is, again, complete polar opposite of what Nostr wants to do. And it's not optimized for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I, on the first day, I talked about kind of, and on the second one, even more in particular, like, what does it mean to build something in the spirit of Bitcoin? What does it mean to build something in the spirit of Nostr? And it's all about kind of, What does your value structure look like, and what kind of sacrifices are you willing to make? And would you just describe these people, and especially product managers and product people or Silicon Valley people, they mostly come from that crowd, and it's like most people think like this, you know, like we've been trained over the decades to think like this. And it's you're sacrificing user freedom either for the sake of convenience or for the sake of apparent speed or whatever. Like you said, you know, it's faster if I serve it from a central database and all those kind of things. And, you know, it's way safer and better for the users if I take care of all the cryptographic key material and, you know, I give them username, passwords and like password reset emails and all this kind of stuff. But you're sacrificing something and not only for the users, but also for yourself, you know, and I always like to point out then, and we see this now with BitChat is the most recent example, right? Like if you are getting big and successful enough in your disruptive technology, someone with a very large stick, either like Google or Apple or the government or like, you know, a quasi-governmental entity will come knocking at your door and shut you down because you hold all the user data and you and so on and so forth.
Yeah, or shut you down, or even worse, bend you to their will.
Yeah, or imprison you. I mean, we saw this also.
Yeah, or imprison you or turn you into, I'm building this thing for freedom and blah, 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 but I'm taking this one shortcut. And all of a sudden, you are literally working for the opposite of what you intended.
Yeah, yeah. And you become an attack vector yourself. You become a single point of failure and all those kind of things. And so, yeah, I think it's all about the underlying value structure. What do you actually want to build? What's your goal?
Yeah.
Do you want to, you know, help make the internet a more free and open place, or do you want to get rich off, you know, whatever, squeezing users and build a product that somehow makes money, just like, you know, we made money in the Web 2.0 era and in the, like, as it is still now on the Silicon Valley side, you bring everyone in, you lock everyone in, you build a really nice prison, you don't let anyone leave, you make everyone either addicted or somehow otherwise reliant upon your service, and then you start to squeeze them, and that's how you get money.
In a way, it's like a different version of the Zuccos triangle. And everybody will also try to bend it, to flatten it.
Yeah. We even had that. I tried to draw it on the. We had the triangle cohort.
Yeah, the CC04.
It was basically, you know, like make money and you know, build freedom tech, and like there was something like that. Like self-sovereign tech, make money, like, and there was a third one. I don't remember it anymore. Good UX, I think, was the third one. It was like pick two. Something like that. But yeah, it's all about the trade-offs. You can't do everything. And I think what I like about the Nostra side of things, the FIP side of things, I thought about this today in the morning, actually, because I, what's his name? What's his handle? Is it Pirate Hash? Something Hash, one of the participants. And I'll speak to him later today. And he mentioned that he listened to every single episode of No Solutions, and I was extremely surprised because I was like, not even I do that, you know, like there literally is a person that listened to every single thing. Insane. So by definition, he's an insane person, but he mentioned it was super helpful for him. He comes from a data science background, is very new to us, is very new to all those kind of things, and he mentioned all these conversations were super helpful to help him get started, wrap his head around the things and so on. And my thinking was like, everyone, like, that's amazing. Even if it's like 20 people, 50 people, whatever, 100 people, when do you have the opportunity to address a room of 100 people and they really listen?
Absolutely.
That's an amazing thing. And they really listen, you know? Like, that never happens. No one has this opportunity.
And
back to the local mesh network, local Nostra side of things. What I always loved about Nostra is, like, it was very apparent to me, you don't need to build an app that's used by like a billion people.
Yeah, 100%.
You build something that's useful for a couple hundred people or a couple thousand people. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Like, what else do you want? And I still hold on to the belief that if this thing is useful enough, some people will also pay money for it. And you don't need millions or billions of users. We have real money flowing through the system. It's very easy to move money around. It's like, you know, like the concept of, I don't know the number anymore, but like 1,000 super fans or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. True fans.
If you have 1,000 users that are like really excited, willing to pay, that's all you need.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need anything else. You don't need to take on Google or Facebook or whatever and so on.
Yeah, I think it comes a little bit, it's another shape of the same mindset of you come at Noster or Bitcoin with all your mental baggage of how to do the thing, right?
Yeah.
We see this with Asians when they try to build Noster things and they, REST, or, you know,
yeah.
How are we going to know that this event is real? There's a signature. and this idea of how you make something that is useful for the past, 20-25 years, the only barometer if you make something that is useful is if billions of people use it.
Mm,
otherwise, yeah. You failed, right? Mm.
That's the Silicon Valley measurement.
It is,
basically.
It is, but, yeah. but it became the standard throughout everything, especially everything that is software, everything that is information, everything that is on
the internet. True. You see it on GitHub as well. Unless you don't have like 100,000 stars, like your project is nothing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things that because it's really hard to, I think, to shake that mental model in all its different forms. Like, it creeps in. And one of the things that, in a way, kind of surprised me is Buzz, the project that Block released.
Yeah, we should dig into that. So that's basically along the lines of 10x, and especially along the lines of the 10x relaunch, which is Mosaico. And we talked about this briefly a couple of days ago, but to me, the most interesting thing about it is that everyone is landing on the same kind of solution to the multi-agent world, how to communicate, how to collaborate problem. And that has me really excited, because that means that if multiple people independently land on the same thing, like, we're onto something.
Yeah.
We're not going in the
completely
wrong direction.
Delusional.
We're not completely delusional. Yeah.
And it's actually interesting that also a pattern that you observe throughout is that you see people that are not aware of, like, the, let's call it our discipline or our corner of the internet.
our special form of psychosis.
Exactly. We should also dig into that, actually. I want to pick your brain on that. That many people that have completely different values, optimizing for completely different things, and they are arriving at similar observations of the nature of the problem of agentic coding and just AI in general. I think just coding is, you know, like the first broadly adopted, completely industry disrupting case, but it's gonna be the same throughout many other things, right? So we are just like the guinea pigs in a way. But you see OpenAI, again, WorldCoin, it's like completely different values, opposite values.
Yeah.
And they arrive at the same observations of what is the limiting factor? I think the limiting factor in vibe coding or in agentic development or whatever, has become very clear for at least 6, maybe 9 months, that it's not the model anymore. It's become very obvious that it's
memory
not,
and communication.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's everything that is around the model. If the model doesn't progress anymore, all the models are, this is the best there will ever be. There's still massive growth in terms of autonomy and the usefulness of the system. And OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, they all keep arriving at the same observation of what the problem is or parts of the problem, and very different approaches to how to solve it. But identity is something that they keep going. And where is the identity? What is the scope of the
identity? The whole thing about
the
orbs is like prove your humanness, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it relates to identity. We want to know that we're interfacing with a human, and everyone else will be declared an agent, basically. And we are obviously, I mean, we talked about this a lot in the past. The Noster flavored solution to that problem is a combination of web of trust and proof of work. And realness basically is defined by a mixture of those metrics in some sense. And of course, this relates also to age, and you can do like Bitcoin-based timestamping, all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we know this also from other decentralized systems like Join Market, where you put up a fidelity bond and you prove realness, future seriousness in that way. Like if I time lock one Bitcoin for 5 years, I'm a serious actor. I'm not part of a million bot farm, you know, like that's at least what you can signal. And yeah, everyone is trying to, at least everyone discovered the same problems. And the solution space to it is very, very different, because the trade-offs that people are willing to make are very different, because the underlying value structure is very different. Like you mentioned, WorldCoin has a different value structure than we have, and OpenAI, and so on.
Yeah, and also the incentives, right?
Sure, like sure.
They observe the right problem, and they are incentivized to solve it in a way that puts them at the center of the thing.
Sure, and they have to do that in a way. They're a company, they're a publicly traded company, and so on. They have to, you know, optimize for shareholder value and value capture and all those kind of things. So that's not very surprising. But let's get into Buzz a little bit, and also, like, maybe as a first step, like, really drill into Buzz and explain how it works and what it is and what it uses underneath and so on. Like, how does it use Noster? What are the trade-offs made and so on? And then after that, maybe let's get into your 10x rebuild into Mosaico and what you discovered along the way, what you learned about trying to build out 10x for the last year and a half or
year
something.
Year and a half or something, yeah, Jesus Christ. Yeah, my God.
So, yeah, Buzz was launched 2 days ago, 3 days ago?
Yeah, a couple of days ago.
Four days ago, something like that. And obviously Jack, got it done, pushed it out, lots of excitement around it. I think it's number one trending on GitHub right now.
Is it?
Yeah, like that, in some time frame at least.
Wow.
Derek Ross, Noster CEO, made me aware of that. So what is Buzz? How does it work? How does it make use of Noster?
So Buzz is... And back to what I said before, that it kind of surprised me. So Buzz is a bunch of things, which is kind of where I where I had landed with 10x before I killed it. So it's a Noster relay. It's a way to run different harnesses via ACP, basically. So you launch whatever agent, like Goose or Cloud Code or Codex, whatever it might be, and it shares one relay, which is a NIP29 relay, as basically as a point of communication.
Yeah. So you can think of it from the old world as a Discord server, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So so each agent. In a very loosely way of using that word, agent, each agent gets a pub key. So you interface with the agents and with other people. So it's like Slack, but with agents in there. And you can add one agent and get it to do something. It's like a different way of collaborating. But also, it has a GitHub replacement within Buzz itself.
So it does issue tracking, pull requests.
It does issue tracking.
Kind of
it does all the things, and it has also, you know, like cron jobs and whatnot to drain this thing, right? Mm-hmm. Drain like this backlog of issues. So the thing that kind of surprised me is that it's so many things, you know. Mm-hmm. Which is what happened to me with 10x. It started requiring everything adjacent to the problem, because all the harnesses Not so much anymore. There is a few standards now, but all the harnesses used to fight you on, no, we want users to interface with our product, you know?
Yeah.
We want Anthropic users to use Claude.
Yeah.
Not Sonnet model, yeah. You know? And it's the same with GitHub and with a bunch of things where, so for example, in my case, since I started rebuilding all the things, of 10x into more modular pieces, I decided to be more pragmatic and just use GitHub. And all of a sudden I realized that, wait, now the agents are commenting on GitHub or publishing PRs as myself.
Yeah.
Because they cannot do it with their pub key. So now I have to create a second account on GitHub, which they all share, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but you can use different names, I think. Like you can
do commits, yeah, with different identity, with, yeah, different emails, right?
Exactly.
But say for example, one agent creates a PR. The PR must be opened by someone from a GitHub account.
Yeah.
And the PR, it's either under my account or under one account that they all share.
Yeah.
So just conceptually, it very obviously starts to make the lines very unclear, you know? Like, who did this? Why? Where's the provenance of this? Whereas a PR that is an event, it's very clear. It's signed, right?
Yeah.
It's very obvious where it came from and what happened.
Yeah, it's very easy. If you do everything Nostr native, it's very easy to associate and have a paper trail, a cryptographically provable paper trail, because everything is signed and everything is linked together.
Exactly. The thing that I think the bus created, it kind of validates what I think everybody has been feeling in a way, that you're using, for most people that are doing any kind of more sophisticated development or more sophisticated environments, you might have Codex in one side, yeah, Cloud Code in some other side, Hermes in another thing, NIP 17 messages here, maybe some Telegram thing here, right? It's a bunch of things, and at the same time you have a bunch of parallel things that are part of why you're doing the thing that you're doing. Like, why are you working in OpenSat? Why are you working in this other project? Why are you working in software engineering? In a way, all that stuff is related.
Sure.
There is something that you can point to that anchors all of those things, right? So I think one of the things that Buzz has is that it shows that people have been hurt by this fragmentation.
Yeah.
Even within Cloud Code and Cloud Code, same terminal window, two different tabs.
Yeah, yeah. The two sessions can't really
interact. And the two
sessions
are like, and then the typical thing is that you become the copy-paste between the two.
Yeah.
And it's like such a, I don't know, it's like a, like Las Vegas casino, you know, reducing a person to push a button,
yeah,
until,
yeah,
some lights come up. It's like the worst expression of humanness.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. You went on about this the last year or so. I mean, what you're referring to is, for example, we don't have sophisticated agent loops. Agents often stop, and all you would have to do is like yes or okay,
mm-hmm,
and then you're sitting in front of the computer or whatever interface you use, and like in 5 minute or 10 minute intervals, you just go yes, yes, continue, okay, yes, let's do it. and Buzz tries to address this issue. And the other thing you mentioned is once you start working with multiple providers, multiple agents, multiple harnesses, those kind of things, everything becomes very fragmented. And doesn't matter what you use, also the communication channels become fragmented. Some communication channels work really well as a one-on-one channel. Some channels work better in like a group setting, those kind of things. And Buzz tries to give you something, give you a set of tools that just makes all of that work. And so basically you have a Slack or like or a Discord like system that your agents live in. You have agentic loops, you have goals that you can define, and you can just, the thing plugs into various harnesses various agent systems and so on. So it's a layer on top. It's a very high layer on top that takes care of, you know, goal setting, issue tracking, communication, orchestration to some degree, and so on. So is that a fair summary?
That is a very fair summary, and it opens the door of what I think it's still missing, which to me, like the NIP 29 or like whatever type of Noster, or you know, whatever type of messaging bus that you use, I just happen to think that Noster gives you a fuckload of really cool things.
Maybe too many. When it comes to DM and DM things and messaging buses, maybe well, too many.
You know, I don't believe in DMs. So.
Everything's public. Everything's kind one.
Telnex, pretty much until it was NIP 29, which is also unencrypted, it was just kind ones.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that's again back to the trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
Like I had a long conversation with Jeff about MLS and Marmot and all those kind of things and how hard it is to do encrypted group chat, right?
Yeah.
And to keep track of the state. And that's how you built the worst thing after the worst thing after NSEC Bunker is the serial killer relay, which tries to address this, like basically building a blockchain on a relay. That's how I see it.
But it's look at how you use that word. On a relay.
Yeah.
On a relay. A single relay.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Almost nothing requires that thing. Almost nothing requires that perfectness of state.
But then it's again, then like why Noster when it's a single relay? To me, the beauty about Noster and Blossom and all the other things is like it doesn't matter where it comes from. You don't have a single relay. You have 10 different relays. And anything that uses one relay to me is already kind of an anti-pattern. I know we're getting in controversial waters now, but it's like...
not to go too deep into the sidetrack, but we'll have to pop up the stack very soon. But for example, your draft. You're writing whatever, a kind one or a long form, and you want to keep your draft, and you want to be able to, which I think is very fair, you are on device A, writing your draft, and you go to device B, and you want to continue your draft.
Yeah.
If device B is not like in sync, quote unquote, in sync with device A, you save your draft, and you destroyed your previous draft.
Sure.
So
sure.
That's pretty much like the only use case, and that's why it's for you, for your relay, to make sure that you don't fuck up your drafts. That's pretty much the only real use case that I see for the serial killer.
Yeah, fair, but it's still just one relay, and it runs on my whatever, my VPS, my start 9, my VPS goes down, everything's fucked, so I want to have two.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me, the killer feature is always redundancy.
No, 100%, but even if you have two, and the two clients and the two relays are out of sync.
Yeah, yeah, you need one to sync the relays.
Yeah, and one of them will have to explicitly override what is the right state of your draft.
Yeah.
So you
sure,
prevent
because you
the
will always have conflicts. I mean,
you will always have conflicts.
Yeah, yeah. Git shows this very clearly.
There is no hiding.
Yeah, yeah. That's completely unavoidable. Yeah. Yeah. So the question becomes how to resolve the conflict. This is a very simple pattern of
making sure, okay, I don't want to destroy my draft accidentally
because
everything went out of sync.
Yeah.
I want to know, when you have a Git conflict, you need to resolve it manually.
Yes.
And Git is not going to say, don't worry, I gotcha.
And you can't.
No, because it's objective.
That's also something that most people or a lot of people don't understand. You can't run away from it. It's a physical.
It is literally impossible.
Like, it's impossible. That's how our universe works.
Yeah.
And that's just, you can't. No global in the universe either.
I'm sure Chandran will have a demo next week.
Chandran has this great line. It's like, everything you say makes sense. But, but I still see it very differently. All right, let's pump up the stack. So NIP 29, and I as a NIP 17 maximalist currently myself, like I fully get the need for NIP 29 and having group chats that actually work and so on. And fair warning or full disclosure, I try to make group chats work with my agent on MLS using Pika and other things. It never worked.
Yeah.
One-on-one was great, but it's not in a state yet where this actually works. NIP 29, I think, is the right trade-off right now. Like you said, it's unencrypted. It's like basically you have a Discord server for everything.
Yeah.
And it's basically, you know, whoever joins is there and is in and can see everything. And I think in a group
Like, I mean, the relay can see everything and the relay can enforce who gets to see
sure,
what.
Sure, you have channels.
But it's 100% trusted on what the relay is going to do.
Yeah. But it's not, you know, there is no double ratchet encryption,
no.
Like the keeping track of the encrypted state, nothing. It's
optimized for you're not going to fuck up your communications.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't pretend to be secure in that way. You know?
And I think for what Buzz tries to be and also what you are trying to build, I think it's a very fine, like a perfectly fine trade-off. Because you are working with people that you trust, you're inside a team, like let's say you work on a company like Block, and you're working on a project, and you know you're trying to make the Square terminals better and so on, and so there is a trust relationship already. You trust your teammates, you trust the people you work with. It's not a highly adversarial environment, and the agents and the agent harnesses and everything that's working on this stuff, you know, there's some trust assumptions there as well. And I think NIP29 is perfectly fine for that, and you landed on NIP29 as well,
100%,
right?
I've been a NIP29 maximalist for a long time, because I think it does everything, almost everything, right. There are a few like design constraints that I think are completely stupid, that Fiat Jeff agreed that they are subpar, but because it has like an RPC style thing, instead of saying this is the channel name or whatever, you are telling the relay, please make the channel name blah, but you know, it's just a pet peeve. But yeah, I don't know. Like within trust, I think within our circles, there is this implicit skepticism of anything that implies trust.
Yeah.
But trust is an absolutely very important. Like I trust that you're not going to stop me right now, so I can relax and I can have a conversation with you. So
bold assumption. Depends on what you're going to say.
I want interested in an NFT.
Once you sent me the serial killer relay link, I wanted to stab you. I was just too far away.
Well, but that's
it was just one.
It
and
was
you
the
knew
inception
it.
Of the
you
name.
Knew it. It was like before the link, there was one line. It was like, you're going to hate this so much. And you're right. You're right. I hate it. But anyway, there was no stabbing, you know, like no violence in cyberspace.
I was saying that I think the regardless of the fabric, which obviously I agree with on Buzz, I think it addresses one part of the problem, which in a way is it's super useful. I mean, obviously it's super useful. I don't think it attempts to address the underlying thing that I'm trying to address, which is like more about the agent autonomy, and is this thing that
tell me more about that, because and by the way, we need to turn around here because I don't think I can do elevation gains in my current state. Again, keep in mind, like I'm very drugged up. it's amazing that I can walk and speak. But you mentioned this a couple of times. Also on Noster, you had some posts about this and so on. And I think almost every single time I talk to you about how you think about the agent human in the loop relationship, basically you had a tweet. I still call them tweets. You had a post.
Fuck
you
it.
Had a tweet on Noster. that basically went like, I can always spend more tokens. I can never get back like a single minute of my time.
Yeah.
So tell me more about this and how you want to address this in Mosaico, how Buzz maybe also addresses this. And one more thing I want to get into. I know it's like three questions now, but... what do you have bring to Buzz to start using it? Because I saw some chatter on Noster where some people had questions. What do you have to bring to Buzz? Like, because I think you need to, you know, like how do you sign up for it? How do you start using it? How do you plug in all the things? And how, like, is this any different to Mosaico? Like, talk to that a little bit
It is. I mean, it's very different to Mosaico because Buzz is more of like a finished contained product. I mean, not a finished product, but it's a package of a bunch of things, right?
Yeah.
So you know, when you have one thing that has 10 different pieces, you need to figure out how you deliver this in a way that people don't kill themselves deploying it. So, you know, deployment is easy because it's a whole package. It's well integrated.
You need to sign up. You create an account.
Download it. You install it on your system, and you just spin it up. You connect it to your local harnesses or whatever, and then you invite people. Basically, you invite people into this one relay, right? Into this one relay and into all the different services that.
But I think that's precisely my question, because I didn't go through the flow yet, so that's why I don't know. But how do you invite them? You invite them by email, and then
no, it's just like a QR link. Code kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
That has an invite code.
If they don't have an Oster account, an Oster account will be created for them.
It's all created.
And they won't really see it, or like, how does the account creation flow look like? Do you know?
I didn't invite someone, so I don't.
What happens to the ANSEC? Is my question. You know,
it's
for new users,
just stored somewhere there.
Yeah.
I cannot speak. With detail on that part.
I'll have to take a closer look for sure. I was just busy building Naplets.
But the thing about the you can always buy more tokens, not more time. That's why I keep going back to what I want is to increase the autonomy of the agents. And their autonomy hides a bunch of different things, right? Because by autonomy, I mean that they will do the thing, that they will do the right thing, that they will not destroy.
Do the thing that you would do.
Yeah, do that, which is, as you know, an impossible problem.
Because you don't even know what you would do.
100%, absolutely, absolutely.
You can't pre-plan it.
But
you need taste and values.
but there are shades of, do I know what I would do? Would I don't know, give the user an email and password and hide their NSEC? I know that I would not do that. So that is not a...
It's a bold thing to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, 2026, all right? 2026. Actually, that's kind of interesting, because I've evolved, so the system should evolve with me.
Yeah.
Right? So that gives you a few hints of where the monsters hide, right? So you need something that will be able to... The things that are... clear calls that you, especially calls that you have already made.
That's where the Pablo replica comes in as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's especially when.
So maybe let's explain that a little bit. You're not always available. So if it's 3 a.m., let's pick a different time. You're sometimes up at 3 a.m.
Oh,
5 a.m.
Let's pick
5 a.m.
There you go.
You're not available. And an agent has a question, and it is a question of that sort, like what design decision should we make?
Yeah.
And so you at least had a Pablo replica agent that's trained on all your stuff and how you see the world, basically.
Yeah.
And so whoever is implementing something and has this question right now can reach out to the Pablo replica agent and just ask, okay, what would Pablo do?
And the
just
most
ask Pablo.
The most interesting thing is that the primitive is. The agents always forget to do the thing.
Yeah.
So if you tell them, by the way, do this, they will always forget.
Yeah. So you have to re-inject it into the context always.
You have to carefully curate the environment where they act in a way that the system will kind of catch them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you
the
can
system
be,
has to remember them.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can be too overbearing, which I did this, the analogy of like we are the... slavery point of economical development.
Yeah.
You can be too overbearing, where literally what you're removing is agency.
Yeah.
You're telling them,
which is a fine line. Everyone who ever worked with a team, has a company, and so on knows that you don't want to micromanage your employees, but you also don't want to like give them completely free rein and anything goes.
So that's
the tension.
For example, on one of the agents that I have now, that is this architecture, like that's more broad designs, there are constraints within each project there are constraints of how the thing should be built and should be architected, ADRs, how they should be architected. And also one of the questions that it must entertain is, if there weren't these ADRs, how would you design it?
Architecture decision records, by the way, for those who aren't in the know.
And what's interesting is that sometimes the ADR, like these decisions of do the thing in this way, might be too overbearing and might be hiding that the decision was not correctly stated at first, which is obviously it's going to be the case.
Or maybe it was even a wrong decision, right?
Like it might be a wrong decision, or it might lack nuance.
You had the one prompt was like, if you could break any ADRs to get it done, which one would you break?
Yeah, or exactly. Like that. And what would that look like?
Yeah.
And is there an actual argument to entertaining this idea, you know? So on one side, the system can be too overbearing. On the other side, the system can be too loose. I think the nuance of navigating these two is not explored enough.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I'm exploring and the direction I'm taking everything. And that's why I think the orchestration
you kind of need both. I mean, I have to quote Vervaeke, you know, like I'm talking to
well,
you.
I mean, it's almost an hour, it's time.
It's way over time. But he talks a lot about opponent processing, where basically and we see this also, that most successful companies, or some of the most successful companies, often have two founders. One highly creative, like anything goes kind of guy, and one kind of, you know, very technical, we have to be strict about things, we actually have to execute and implement kind of guy. And the opponent processing between the two guys is what makes everything work. Like, 100%. You have to work together, you have to figure this out together, you have to find the middle way, kind of. And that's also how our brains work. That's why, you know, we have brainstorming sessions and we have debugging sessions. Yeah. You know, very, very different frame of mind, very different modus operandi of how you look at the problem. What is allowed and what isn't allowed.
Even you are facing a problem and you go and take a walk and then you come back.
Absolutely. And that's why we do those things. 100%. And that's also, you know, like getting into a different state of mind, you can do all kinds of things. And so the finding the right, he wouldn't even say balance, Vervaeke. Vervaeke would say the right tonos between those in the sense of tension.
Right.
But a good kind of tension, just like, you know, you need to, the guitar strings need to have the right tension so that they work properly. You know, this kind of tension between those two kind of polar opposites, or between those two poles, that's the art of getting anything done, basically. And in the agentic world, this means you need to build a system that can build up this tension and know, like, when do we need to get more strict? When can we be more loose? And that obviously maps on roles, that maps on different phases in the design process, but like if you're building out a specification, you know, you want to be more strict. If you want to build out a test suite, for example, you want to build more strict. If you're in the ideation phase and you don't really know yet what you want to build, like anything goes, and you go broad and you go brainstormy and so on. So yeah, it all comes back to cognitive science, man. I'm telling you.
It really does.
It all comes back to John Vervaeke. Whether you can pronounce his name or not, it doesn't matter.
He's at the center.
And it also...
He's the centralization problem.
One more thing. Like, that's why I talked about the book on dialogue in day one. I highly encourage everyone to read this book. It's the same thing. That's why dialogue is so important. That's why we're having these dialogues and like you have to integrate these different viewpoints and work with the tension that is built up and find the middle way through, basically. That's the best we have. There's no silver bullet.
It comes down to the fact that you go into the dialogue where neither party knows what's the answer.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's a process. It's like just like memory, how memory works. It's a process. It's not like one part of the brain. But so I think the Buzz addresses like this part of the communication. It doesn't attempt to solve the lack. Not a lack of hierarchy, because I think you still need some type of coordination even between humans and agents. You do need the coordination, like the explicit coordination. But when you replace you yourself copy-pasting text from one agent to another, and you replace an agent that will copy-paste or direct the work that two other agents are doing, you kind of automated the inferior approach. You kind of automated the less conducive approach to autonomy. And this is something that it's interesting because I've felt this while building 10X, where the moment I gave agents a way to communicate amongst themselves without across project boundaries, I've noticed that the level of autonomy increased dramatically. But it was the approach that I was taking was, I'm giving a tool for the agents to communicate. You know, it's not, I'm allowing communication in the primitive, you know. I'm adding a tool instead of I'm creating an environment where the tool doesn't need to exist.
Where they themselves figure out.
Where they themselves figure out when
they
to use
can
what.
Communicate.
Exactly.
They have the innate ability to communicate, and it's their decision when to use it.
Exactly.
That's the difference. Now.
That is exactly it. And to me, that's what kind of absolutely fascinated me about, you know, I think in one episode that we recorded, you told me, when you're done with 10X, it's going to be ChatGPT.com.
Yes, I remember.
In a way that is so fucking true. It is so true. To the point where literally the website ChatGPT.com now is part of my environment.
Yeah, but for different reasons. It's free inference.
For different reasons, yeah. It's insane, free inference. But it's actually interesting because it is... ChatGPT.com knows that it's not just a whole. It knows it's part of my overall system. It knows it can see.
Yeah, you built an MCP server for ChatGPT.
I built an MCP server
that's how it works, right?
Makes ChatGPT.com use Mosaico, which
it's basically now a Mosaico interface.
One of many. Yeah. Exactly.
And inside Mosaico, you have to talk to me more about the. You hinted at some of the emergent behavior that you were observing.
Which is the most fascinating part.
In terms of once you have multiple agents working on multiple things, and once they realize that, once they have an awareness of not only themselves, but the agent swarm and what they are working on, right?
Yeah.
Then interesting things happen because it's like they might run into an issue. And they might get whatever, like there's a bug in the library and it's a very weird... error output that they get, and they might start searching for that error output, like how do I fix this error?
Yeah.
And in their search scope is all the conversations and the whole context of the whole swarm, right?
That's
so
right.
Some other agent that worked on a completely different project but used the two weeks ago ran into the same issue.
Yeah.
And then they can start communicating. They will automatically start communicating hey, I have the same issue.
That's the absolutely important part, and that is the crucial part that you cannot fake.
Yeah.
That part where they start doing it because it's relevant. I know,
we're
I'm freaking.
We're making.
When it's relevant to them, where the work of someone else is salient.
There you go. Salient landscaping. We got all the buzzwords.
When you don't introduce yourself saying you need to collaborate with this other agent because it's working on something that is similar to what you're facing, the moment you're doing that, you kind of lost.
Yeah.
Which is the current paradigm.
Yeah.
That's how it works if you have two cloud code sessions.
Yeah.
If you have a very sophisticated environment with two cloud codes and one codex that is orchestrating both of them, or if you have a bus, or it's all different ways of doing the same thing, which is directing what should the agent pay attention to?
Mm-hmm.
And now, anyone that has built harnesses or looked like into how you actually build the context window of an agent and, you know, what do you put in there? It's just append messages or whatever, would immediately get triggered with, you must be fucking polluting the context window to an insane point, which was what 10X was doing. 10X was add more tools, notice a failure, add a tool to fix the failure, add information on how to use the tool and when to use it, blah, blah, blah. I cannot spell out, you would obviously know this, I cannot spell out all the times where you should communicate with some other agent. It is literally impossible. There are infinite cases.
Yeah. Where that should happen. Combinatorial explosion.
Absolutely.
Buzzword.
Absolutely. We're about to get bingo. So Mosaico takes the opposite left side. I mean, Mosaico is like super left side of the curve.
I love it already.
It literally only says, it gives you the context of on which project, like with Git repo or whatever it's working on, that there is a bunch of others. It literally just shows these are all the workspaces. I don't call them projects, I call them workspaces, but they map basically one-to-one to just Git repos. And just the fullest, not even description. Literally only, okay, I have a project that is called NMP, I have a project that is called 10X, I have a project that is called software engineering, I have a project that is called household shit, you know, everything. But I probably have, I don't know, maybe like 200 of these containers. Nah, definitely less than 200.
Feels like 200 someday.
Oh, yeah.
A couple dozen.
And they only see more detail, very, very narrow detail, of what's going on in the project where you're at right now. So right now, they are joined in the workspace of whatever, of the whatever, the household chores project. And you can see, that's a bad example, let's use a software example. I open a cloud code session within the Mosaico codebase. And there is another agent that has been active in the same root channel, it's just a NIP29 chat channel, and it sees 4, 5, maybe 10 words of what that agent is tasked with. Basically, you know, like how Cloud Code or Open Code, they create the title of the session, kind of like that, basically. This is what I'm tasked with. So the context that I'm injecting, it's almost nothing. It is your skills, like just broadly the skills that people have, probably inject, I don't know, orders of magnitude more lines into the context or tokens than what I'm injecting with Mosaico. But what happens?
So it's basically pointers that they can follow.
When they think that it's relevant.
Yeah.
When they think that it's relevant. So some of the emergent behaviors that I've noticed, which I think is, it's like, I don't know, to me it kind of fascinates me that it actually works, because it sounds so unlikely that something so stupid would work. But say I notice a bug on Mosaico, and I tell the agent, oh, this is happening when I do blah, 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 this shit happens, investigate or whatever. So on Codex, let's say. And Codex starts working to identify what is the problem, blah, blah, blah. Then maybe a bit later, I identify some other bug that I've noticed. And I tell Cloud Code, hey, when I do this, it's kind of slow, for example. Like this shit, it takes some time to resolve whatever. And it starts investigating. And what has happened many, many, many times is that so they see each other, right? They see on their context, they see that they're working, this guy is investigating why something fails under these conditions. This other guy investigates why resolution of some Noster event is slow, right? Completely unrelated things, but they see each other. But they don't find anything relevant on their work. They don't see any overlap on the work with regards to that will trigger them into saying, oh, we should talk, you know? Mm-hmm. Because they don't chat amongst, I mean, they can, but they typically don't chat.
They typically don't.
Yeah, yeah, they typically just stay in their lane, basically.
Yeah.
They might sometimes interact when there is like someone is gonna write a conflict, and even though they're in the independent Git work trees, they will create a conflict, so maybe they usually they channel as a mutex, basically, you know, to say, oh wait, stop, because I'm gonna change that, then you can put your changes later, okay, or something. Yeah. But the interesting part that has emerged many, many times is that multiple times the two very seemingly unrelated bugs are actually the same bug. It's just two very different symptoms of the same bug.
Yeah.
And many times I've seen the both agents start to collaborate because they realize that they're kind of trending towards the same thing via realizing that they are moving into something that is getting closer and closer together, you know?
Okay.
Maybe same problem coming at it from different perspectives. And many times when you identify that the problem is kind of related and you're coming at it from different problems, you observe that the real solution is not what you would have immediately solved if you only knew about one of the symptoms.
Yeah, I see. I see. So, basically, if there is a root underlying problem, getting at it from multiple perspectives is always helpful. And that's where dialogue and communication comes into the picture. And then if you have one solution that solves all the problem cases you discovered, all the cases, all the different viewpoints on the problem that you have, then it's a very good solution. The likelihood is very high that it's a very good solution.
And you know, just from how agents tend to work, that they tend, because they need to, we'll talk about proactive context as well, but they tend to, when you tell them there needs to be, this code base has this bug, you open a new session, and sure, it loads your agents.md and whatever else you have, but for the most part, they need to research, what the fuck are you talking, like, what is this code?
Yeah, sure, they have to
they
build
start
up
from
context
scratch.
From scratch all the time.
And because you are exploring, they are exploring kind of from scratch all the time, very easy to miss things. So very often when you tell them to fix a bug somewhere, they will fix the part where identify, and they might just be masking a symptom.
Absolutely.
Not getting to the root
cause.
That
happens all the time.
All the time.
But that's also, I talked with Sandwich a little bit about this. That's why I always use the Socratic method for anything, basically, because it helps to automatically build up more context.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, I never go like, go fix this bug. I go like, okay, like what's like this feature we added recently, what did it touch upon?
Yeah.
And then it's like, is it possible that this feature might have introduced a bug in this other functionality? And so on. Like, it's a very different approach, right? And you're already, like, just with those two questions, you have a massive amount of context. And then it's like, what are the top three, top three suggestions to fix the bug, you know? And then it's already like, I'm not looking for one, I'm looking for three.
100%.
Give me a top three. And then it might, you know, like, discover the root cause more easily or fix the bug more properly and not just like a weird, you know, like duct tape on top hot fix that breaks three other things.
So one thing that is interesting, because that is a process-oriented solution to...
Yeah, it's manual labor on my
part. Yeah, it's manual labor. No, but I think it has a bunch of merit as well. Obviously, it works. But it's like a process way of arriving at something explicitly that can come up implicitly.
Yeah. You're trying to build a framework, a system that has this as an emergent behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And where within the bounds of this emergent behavior, the Socratic method that you bring can also benefit.
Yeah.
Why? Because you might start this conversation with this agent on how do we do blah, blah, blah. Like how can, you know, like these open-ended questions. And it might, during its exploration, find that there was a different perspective at a similar conversation that you had with an agent yesterday or a week ago, and it might, or that is adjacent to the nature of the problem.
Yeah.
And it might bring it into the fold. And what it does that is cool is that they create more like niche channels that are like sub-channels. Yeah. For example, you might have like a research channel, and they might say, okay, within research, what are we actually researching? And it can be whatever. So if there are like a few different agents working on something that is relatively similar, they they self-organize into say, oh, let's take this conversation instead of just polluting and orchestrating and discussing, let's create a channel. And so they niche down and they bubble up whatever might be relevant to the parent channel.
In Mosaico, how does stuff get looped into the fold? And I think that leads into the proactive context discussion. But tell me a little bit about the technical details of whatever. Like I'm just gonna call it agent loop now, but that's probably the wrong word for it. But what are the instructions in terms of like that you have in there? Like look at the list of the projects.
Nothing.
But explain to me how the lookup works and how it works.
So
you understand my question?
Yeah, I do. So what I've noticed is that the more overbearing you are with the instructions on do this thing when this happened, the more if this then that, or the more N8N approach of things, the more they only see that environment as a conduit to do the things that you prescribed to do. Mm-hmm. If you leave it open-ended and they identify that there is a bug in project A.
Well, that's fine. I understand this conceptually.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me really exactly how it works, how you build it.
Okay,
how it works.
Literally,
how does it work? Literally, that's my question.
The only thing that it does is when you open Cloud Code, Open Code, or whatever, there is a session start hook that says a new session has started, right?
Yeah.
You just started a new session. It registers, there is an admin key that is admin of all the channels.
Okay.
That is just like a management key within the system.
So it's you
just
can
like
the create Mosaico a new demon. Channel in the NIP29.
Yeah, it's just the Mosaico daemon is off, like, it can create channels and it can invite other people, basically.
Yeah.
So the management key provisions these adds into whatever channel you launched. It adds this new agent session.
Every new session gets a pop key, right?
Almost. So I realized that is almost always the right approach. I was very adamant that was not the approach for like a year. I think almost always you only want a context window that is concerned with its immediate concern of things, with an immediate task, if you will. But when you have higher order agents that need to have a more holistic picture.
Yeah, your CEO has a
CEO.
Permanent identity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. We talked about this a little bit already. Like the grant work is done by contractors. They're interchangeable kind of.
Exactly.
And the higher up you go in the hierarchy of upper management, the more consistent the identity.
Exactly. Yeah. And the more of a broad understanding. Yeah. They don't need to know, okay, line 5 needs to make this change. They don't need that level of understanding, that grant of granularity.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how we organize work.
Yeah, exactly. We're rebuilding.
Exactly. But if something happens that is relevant to a more higher order style agent, that thing that happened that is relevant, that has been deemed relevant to someone enough to ping, you know, to tag that chief CEO agent.
And how do they see kind of the conversations? Like that's my question.
When they can join, create.
Because what do you post to the NIP29 channel? You don't post everything in there.
No. Super selective. I mean, the agents decide at each step when something is relevant to the rest.
But you will need to have some instruction in terms of like if you did something like after every run, give an update to the
No. They typically they don't even do that. Because the more you add.
No, but I think you're still misunderstanding my question.
Oh.
Just because they have an admin key to a NIP29 thing, that doesn't mean that anything happens. They need to know when to post.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do you instruct them when to post?
I don't.
But you're still understanding my question, right? If you don't instruct them, how come they post and when do they post?
Because they see that someone else is doing something that is related to them.
But how do they see it? I feel like we're going in circles.
Okay, so I have the session.
You have a codex session. I get that. You have a cook. I get that. You have an admin key. I get that. They have the permissions. I get that.
Right.
But how come anything happens without any instruction?
So the hook returns context. And that's how we inject things into the. So they see. That's how they don't choose to see what is everybody up to. they get inside the context, they see Asian blah blah.
So Mosaico regularly injects.
Constantly
injects. When
delta based, obviously, you know. Okay. If there is something that changed, it introduces
the delta.
And
in terms of the change set, what is the delta? Is it conversations in the NIP 29 repo, or is it whatever is it?
It's conversations, it's new Asians coming in, new Asians leaving.
So it's Mosaico events, basically, in some sense.
Yeah, you can call it that. Yeah.
It's not like code changes, that's what I'm trying to say.
No.
Okay.
No.
So it's otherwise a higher abstraction.
Everything.
That's my point.
It's maybe every once in a while,
yeah.
There is, a new agent came in and is doing this one thing. It's one line.
So in some sense, the NIP 29, like Discord server, acts as like the meeting room or something.
Yeah.
And if something important enough happens in the meeting, like whatever happens in the meeting gets injected to all the context windows.
When an agent, say for example, you have two agents that one of them realizes that the other one, and it sees the other one because it doesn't have a choice, it's injected that this other guy that you don't know about is working on this one thing.
So the relevance, what is relevant is dictated by Mosaico who does the context injection.
Mosaico is not running an LLM at all.
Okay.
It has no intelligence. Okay.
Injects the whole context and the agent figures out what's relevant.
Yeah, the whole context sounds like a lot. It is literally just agent
the channels,
blah.
The reasons.
It's just the channels that the agent has joined.
Okay.
The workspaces that exist.
Yeah.
Right? And like how active the workspaces are, you know, if it's like a project that has been parked for 6 months, then it might not even get there.
And it was you that figured out that right level of abstraction, basically. That was an active design choice.
It was a design choice, but it was very clear that the less you give and the more hints you provide.
It's pointers. It's all just pointers.
It's all just pointers. Yeah.
So it's already a summarization. It's already a... And that's where naming comes in, and all, like the projects have to be properly named, the channels have to be properly named, the agents to some degree have to be properly named, because
but
names are pointless.
In a way, we are walking down here, and, it goes back to a typical Burbank example, but we are walking down here, and we're thirsty. All of a sudden, the water fountain becomes immediately obvious that it's relevant to, and we might have walked by it and not seen it a million times.
Yeah,
right?
You never know that there was a public water fountain there.
Exactly. Ever. So and something that happens constantly, and again, for coding agents, I don't have any type of explicit accrual of relationships or long running memory or anything like that, you know. Coding, like my codex agent is for the most part like the typical codex agent. There's not a whole lot of scaffolding around it.
Yeah, the repo is the memory for you.
To some
degree. And the conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I do have other artifacts which comes from
the
proactive context stuff and whatnot.
Yeah.
But if an agent is working on project A, on exploring some kind of bug, and then it identifies that there's a library called whatever Noster library, and that it thinks it's related to that, and all of a sudden it sees in its context the same fucking name.
Yeah.
It becomes immediately obvious, and this happens basically like 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Where it just joins the general channel of that project, and when it joins. In the moment it runs the join command, which is literally just a CLI, or an MCP, it's both.
I mean, some people might notice, like agents will create pull requests and issues for upstream projects, right? If they run into something, same idea, right?
Yeah.
Same
behavior. But what's cool is that the moment they join the channel, all of a sudden they gain the overview of what work is being done here, because it sees, there are three sessions.
Yeah.
And this has literally happened on Monday after the walk. I went back and I saw, because I was preparing like slides, and I saw that one agent, two different sessions, two bug reports that I identified. To me, they were completely distinct. They were both identified independently that they were NMP bugs. Both agents joined the NMP room. And they saw that there was this one codec session refactoring something, and it sounded kind of relevant. So they P-tagged that agent in the NMP room, saying, oh, I'm here for from the whatever project. I found this thing. To me, whatever. To me, it sounds, I don't know, I put the screenshot on the on the README. But it kind of tells the agent that it's refactoring something that sounds kind of relevant. I found this bug.
Yeah.
Like, I've observed this symptom. I didn't look at the NMP codebase.
Yeah.
It just sounds similar. And I've observed this symptom, and it reports the symptom.
Yeah.
So now the refactoring agent knows that what it's refactoring is not just a refactor.
It got an additional
There's more dimensions to it.
Yeah.
So then they can start proactively researching when it matters, or identifying, oh, where are these two symptoms coming from, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it just gains a broader picture. So, but the mechanics is just that. It's just inserting the delta of what changed on state. When there are messages, they see the messages.
Yeah.
With like, if they join the channel, they see the messages. If they are p-tagged, it inserts a user message into, like, if you're running Codex, and some other agent p-tags that agent, it literally inserts into the terminal in XML. I know you're happy about that.
No, I just asked why XML. You never answered.
No. I checked, and it's the thing that has the least failure modes on, like, what if you give them JSON or if you give them Markdown. If there's a structure, if there's some type of hierarchy, XML is the one that they do the best.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So what sounds like to kind of zoom out a lot, not only a little bit, but a lot. To me, it's interesting that the reason why we landed on all these structures in the software development world, and also just in general, how to run a company, how to structure humans, how to structure society even, is like network. People by their nature have to be networked beings, because no single person is all powerful, all knowing, you know, all encompassing, omnipresent, and so on. Like, that's not in our domain.
Yeah.
And you know, like, if people would listen to John Verveke, they would realize, and that's what Anthropic and everyone else doesn't understand yet, I feel like, agents also will never be all powerful, all knowing, 100%. And so on.
Absolutely.
You can't have one agent that is specialized on every domain, that's also a generalist and so on. Like, we talked about this a lot. Like, that's...
That he wakes up in the morning and fires up its own session because it had this dream.
you generalization and specialization are in eternal contradiction to each other and so on. And so you humans, by definition, to solve any complex problem, have to network. We are networked beings for that reason. That's why communication at the logos and so on is so important. And now, because of the same fundamental limitations of our universe and how things work, we're finding out that the same is true for agents.
Yeah.
And Verveke talked about this, I think it was like 3 years ago or something like that, you know? When all this stuff was coming up, it's like, you know, all the AI researchers, they will run into this, like, just from a pure cognitive science perspective, that's how things work.
Yeah.
And you have these eternal trade-offs, you have these, like, he has all these lines, I don't even know all them by heart, but basically the stuff that makes us so adaptive to our environment also makes us self-perceptive, for example.
Right.
That's why agents hallucinate,
right,
which is lying, of course, you know? So nice that we call them
romantic,
hallucinations.
Romantic.
Yeah. And the Silicon Valley people are so romantic. And so what we are looking at now is not one single thing. Like, we're not looking at one single human. We're looking at a company, or we're looking at a society or whatever. And so it's a networked being. So what you're describing and what you are working with is a networked system with all its flaws.
Yeah.
So you can't have a global state. It's impossible, because communication is never instant. Stuff needs to bubble up and bubble down at the same time. So, and Verveke talks about this also a lot. It's like you have top-down constraints, you have bottom-up emergence. That's also something that is in tension with each other, you know, and you have to find the right tonos. You have to, also for a project, everyone knows this, everyone who ever built a project knows this, you have a vision how this thing looks like, and then you work with the fundamentals, and the fundamentals sometimes don't allow 100%. What you have in mind.
100%.
And then you have to figure out a way. How can you still, what are the right trade-offs to still make it work? What can you cut away from the vision to still be kind of aligned, but actually make it work? And so on. I'll just need to catch my breath.
Yeah.
and so to me, it's fascinating that we are, and by we, I mean the broader mm-hmm. people working with agents ecosystem, are landing on the same structures and things and making the same discoveries that we made just purely with humans, like water cooler conversations. Yeah. Some of the things that are happening in your NIP29 thing in the chat, they are water cooler conversations.
I was very tempted to call the general channel water cooler.
Yeah.
Because of that reason.
Because it's like, I've been working, you know, like you bang your head against something and then you need a break, you grab a coffee and so on, you go to the water
cooler. And if there is a work session that you can do with your mate, you go to somewhere else, you go to a whiteboard, you go away from the whiteboard, from the water cooler, and you start iterating.
You open a new channel, basically, and you go here, attach it out, and so on. You might pair a program,
you might pull out a whiteboard, you go on a walk.
Exactly, yeah. And so all that's happening, and that's why, just to bring it back to the beginning, I think, like, everyone is realizing this. Mm. Everyone wants to kind of build this. That's how Buzz came about as well. And again, like Buzz, since Jack knows a thing or two about Nostr, based on NIP29, all these kind of things as well. And I feel like to solve any sufficiently complex problem, all this stuff is necessary. Like there is no shortcut. There is no silver bullet. You can't just have one all-knowing dictator that does everything perfectly. You can't have one agent that does everything perfectly. You can't have the same person who has the big vision and draws the whole architecture and also does the nitty-gritty implementation. Those are two different people. They have to be, right? And same with, like, the guy who implements it and the guy who writes the tests, you know? Or the guy who does the user testing.
100%. You know? and in a way, the what you just said, the grand vision guy cannot be the same guy that is writing the code and whatnot. I think that is understood, you know, a bit in a way. But the current state of affairs is this grand vision guy is the one telling this guy what to do, directing its actions. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where we are still at a very early understanding.
Still too top down
too
in some
top
sense.
Down.
And you want too more bottom up, more emergence.
I think that economy and just history has proven that is a better system.
Yeah,
it's local intelligence. It's local intelligence.
Sovereignengineering.io/books, the cathedral and the bazaar.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And in a way, like the paperclip, you know, like the analogy of the paperclip
maximizing.
It's an analogy of the same problem. It's scoped the problem of what it's doing to its immediate concerns. It doesn't understand that there is a point to making the paperclip that is more
it's missing the context.
It's missing the context.
It's just the context problem.
It is literally missing the context. All it knows is paperclip, more. Good.
And my favorite example of the paperclip maximizer is YouTube and TikTok. The platform itself doesn't know that YouTube might be a good tool to disseminate knowledge, for example. And that's not the goal. The goal is to maximize shareholder value and quarterly profits. And the way the platform's found to do that is to harvest eyeballs and brain cycles, capture the time and attention. And so they are parasitic on our nervous system, on our psychology and everything, on our reward cycles. And they hijack that completely. And that's the paper clips that they are maximizing.
Right, 100%.
And I mean, to some degree, the people running it know this, but the platform itself, if you wanna make an entity out of the platform itself, doesn't know that. So it's missing the context that, you know, like YouTube will die and TikTok will die quicker if you make all people kind of addicted and stupid and humanity dies out because of it. So the grander context is lost. So it's interesting to frame it as a context problem.
The point where you point to the platform itself as an organism, it's kind of like Harari is his name?
It wasn't Harari, it was
Terms and Steel, that it says that wheat colonized men, forcing him to act and change his way of being and his way of relating to the environment.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to work for the wheat.
We didn't cultivate wheat, but wheat cultivated
man. And in a way, it's the same thing. Where a non-sentient being.
Yeah, I mean, you can say the same about dogs, right? Like, did we tame the wolf or did the dogs, you know, like from the dog's perspective?
It's a really
good deal. So yeah. Yeah, no, I like to flip it around somehow. It's very helpful. I mean, I obviously did this in the past with looking at the internet as a thing that had to find a way to monetize itself, right? Like it had to find some monetary token. Once you become a sufficiently complex networked organism, you have to find some token of value, some monetary token to make yourself work. And again, it comes back to attention. What to pay attention to? That's in large part what the market, the economy is for. You know, if there's a shortage, prices shoot up. We have to pay attention.
What do you optimize for? What do you ration? What do you care for?
Exactly.
What do you don't
sell? Exactly. And what do you care for as well? And that's why I think the internet is so broken right now, because the money the internet uses, the token the internet uses, is a token of time and attention. And the issue is you can't have any capital formation. You can't save time, like stack.
Right.
You can't stack sets, but you can't stack time, you can't stack attention, and so everything is kind of parasitic and out of whack and really bad. But anyway.
But it's interesting that I think that the concept of like the attention economy and all these things has become complete mainstream. Mm-hmm. Everybody is kind of aware of this this nature.
Yeah.
And kind of no one can do anything about it. You know, like we are in a way working towards providing alternatives and all these things, but even the people that are more directly
we know about the debt spiral and we can't do anything about it. Like globally speaking, the US is going bankrupt, most countries, every country basically is going bankrupt, all this is coming to a halt. You can't do anything about it. Also on the AI side, like we know we're living in you know, fairy tale subsidy land on the AI side right now. Everyone knows this won't go on forever. There's people like you getting 50k, like
now
50k,
way more.
50k USD out of inference, even without a subscription, like out of ChatGPT.com, for example.
Yeah.
You know, like infinite inference for zero money. And we all know this can't go on forever. But yeah, the way out of it, like on the fiat side, for example, the way out of it is just personal exit, personal realization exit. Yeah. I don't think
it's also what Verivaki talks about a lot with the local communities
and
points of realization, points where they cultivate this observation and whatever shape it might take. I think software engineering in a way is literally that.
But
it could also be just a meditation retreat.
Yeah,
right? It's like different shapes of the same of the same
and
idea.
Like how do you exit the 24-hour news cycle? You know, like it's very hard to remove yourself from it and like it has an effect on you and everyone and we can't make it stop. You can't just have the individual decision to opt out of it and just, you know, not give a shit about it anymore, basically, and just live your life. All right, a little bit of shade.
Yeah.
For any last words?
The last part I want to explore a bit with you. Actually, I wanted to do two.
And just to go back to the stuff you mentioned before with the injecting into the context, that's what you call proactive context, right?
So I have two different projects both of them were 10x, right? So 10x had like all these ideas in one package. And then I started removing and make them like just modules, Unix style. We talked about this.
More composable.
More composable.
It
does like irreducible complexity of it does one thing. I cannot take anything out anymore.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's the thing that now can provide value on its own. If I take something else out, it just doesn't give it any more value. So that Mosaico is this like awareness layer and self-organization layer. Again, without any direction.
Awareness layer, I like that. That's really good.
I've been rewriting the README, and awareness layer is the like the word that keeps, I don't know, I keep gravitating back. I'm aware that there is more, and then there is someone else.
That's good. That's really good. I like that. Awareness layer. Yeah, that sounds that sounds very, very fitting. Like, that really resonates with me.
And the proactive context is, it's the name of the project. But I think I need to change the name. But the idea of proactive context is that, I told you this, that you open Codex or whatever model, and someone in Wall Street opens Codex, and it's exactly the same interface, it's exactly the same model, but you are going to direct it in one direction, and the person in Wall Street is going to direct it in a completely different direction, and it will go in that direction. Everything else is the same. The only different thing is what you brought to the table, right? Yeah. Where did you point to? So if you extrapolate from that, what is the most important thing that agentic development or contact with AI, what is the most important thing? Is the user message, is what are you saying? So, and what this I identified very early on, like at SEC04. That's why I started every single time I would communicate with an agent. It would always be a kind of one sign on the relay and all that, because I realized I'm telling why to go in this direction, which is super interesting, because if you think how development used to work is you would write the code, you would have ideas. The ideas would manifest in code. The why behind the code was very implicit, very implicit. You know, Bitcoin is one such thing where it takes you a really long, if you only read Bitcoin, like the code of Bitcoin, understanding why 10 minutes, it will take you a really long time, a lot of thinking. Or you can read a paper.
Where do the 10 minutes come from? Great question for people new to Bitcoin.
but if you read the sign or whatever, like observation of why is it 10 minutes, it will become clear way faster, way easier. And I think that's a lot of the work that you did with 21 lessons and like all your writing. Now, when you communicate with the agent and you tell him, no, don't do it this way. No, don't put a REST API there. No. You are very conducive to explain why you're going in this direction. It's not just code anymore. It's code anchored with explicit hints. And if you grab the whole corpus, which is the what ChatGPT has been working on analyzing all my corpus, you can see implicit values that come from what you're explaining. Yeah, because you end up explaining.
There's a cypherpunk way to building things, and there's a Wall Street way to building things, and there's a Silicon Valley way to building things.
Exactly. And when you're communicating with AI, you are leaving all these hints. It's like you're writing a book on how to think about this project and how do they communicate and how they relate and all these things. So proactive context is this project that also runs as a hook. It integrates into Codex, onto whatever you want. And all it does is whenever you write a user message, it keeps it. And it starts, you know, just you're having a conversation or whatever. And at some point, you know, like debounced or you exit the session or whatever, it captures the whole conversation. What you said, what the assistant said and you responded to. Because most things are in communication with agents are implicit. You say, build a calculator. You don't say, pull a multiplying function. Mm. But after some time of you interacting with the thing, you imply that you accept that there is a multiplication function, right?
Yeah.
But if you say, build a calculator, and immediately you say, no, I meant a Fahrenheit to Celsius calculator. Okay, now immediately you know, calculation, division, all that is explicitly rejected from this, right? So the proactive context, all it does is like also super simple. It grabs all these things and it saves them. It just keeps them. Mm-hmm. It put on a Git repo.
Fully or compressed in some way?
That's the interesting part. If you compress them, you introduce hallucinations. If you allow an LLM to clean up and reshape what you said, for sure you're going to end up with things that are not actually what you said. Mm. You only want what you have certainty. You know, like bad context is worse than no context. Mm. So you only want injected what you have some certainty that is actual, you know? So that's where the thing starts to become more complex, because the way it works is it compiles. It does compile with LLM, sort of like a wiki of anchoring on, we know the user said this. We have this amount of certainty, roughly, that the user also wants this. You know, there's been a multiplication function for 2 weeks, you know, like 200 user turns. Probably the user doesn't mind that there is, but they never explicitly said calculation is part of the product set. And obviously I'm using a very stupid, a very simple example.
No, it's a good
example. Extrapolates to anything, right? Yeah. So all it does is it captures the nouns. I did a lot of experiments. I think this is the one that was the most successful. Every time you say a noun in the user message, it captures this probably is a thing. So for example, if you say, what is function, blah, blah, blah.
You try to build up an ontology of some sorts.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm. If you say, what is function, blah, 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 what does it do? You refer to the function as a noun, but maybe you say, that's fucking retarded, delete it, right? Mm-hmm. So just because you mentioned it doesn't solidify that it's part of the thing, right? So it over time, it starts to derive what is part of the nature of the problem. You know, if I keep saying the GUI or the
don't build a REST API, don't build a REST API, don't build a REST API, it doesn't mean that we want a REST API.
But it will actually, it will actually see REST API repeated a bunch of times. Yeah. It will create an entry on the wiki with all your time saying, don't build a REST API, don't build...
Yeah.
With typos.
Okay.
It's a literal copy of what you said and what you reacted to.
Yeah. So the data structure, you use a wiki as the database.
It is markdowns. Yeah. It's all markdowns. Yeah. There is, it's markdowns, and then for... the cassettes, like each session, it's a cassette. Mm-hmm. It's on Markdown and on JSON because then you can do like JQ and okay, give me just all the user messages very easily. So it's also JSON. And it does a bunch of other things. Like there is a lot of other nuance because there's things that get injected into the user message that are not things the user actually said, you know. Mm-hmm. But typically those are surrounded by XML or they look different. Yeah. You know, like I type lowercase, for example. So it, at some point it does like a cleanup of this doesn't look like what Pablo would write. It might be copy-pasted from the website.
That's very specific to your writing style.
No, but you also have a writing style.
Yeah.
That if you copy from an LLM...
No, sure.
At some
but the
point
way
you
it's
can...
built now, it's built for your writing style.
No, it literally is like to extrapolate what are like... You know, we have... like a watermark in how you write, how you use punctuation. Like Satoshi.
Ah, okay.
Satoshi had like very specific...
Yeah, double spaces.
Yeah, double spaces, exactly. Yeah.
So it will figure this out. And
it will figure it out over time of accruing enough corpus.
Okay.
And it's just like a cleanup phase.
That's part of proactive context that it goes over the user input and periodically basically will learn what is...
It cleans up.
What is user context?
Because
like what is user written, user produced?
To me, I would much rather the user have to repeat something that they already said than injecting something that the user never said.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's I want to highlight two things that you said. Like the one is no context is better than bad context. Bad context will lead to confusion and like
destruction.
Also between people, right?
Yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
There's a misunderstanding and then you talk beside like... Like, what's the phrase? Again, I'm medicated. But it's like, I think we're talking about one thing and you think we're talking about another thing. And it goes off the rails quickly.
100%.
And the other thing was like, in the very beginning of talking about this, you mentioned that all that matters is the user input. Like if a Wall Street guy and I myself, we take the same code accession, same model, everything. The only thing that matters is user input. And 100%. So that's why
it's
you focus
everything.
Only on the user input.
Everything. Yeah. It's everything. Yeah. To the point where...
Sorry to interrupt, but it's so beautiful.
Oh, my God. Yeah, there we go.
The pirate ship. Fantastic. Great.
It's been with us the whole dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. we walk the same path.
I find that the part where I want to maximize for... no bullshit going in, or I mean, the bullshit that I said going in, to the point where proactive context itself, it literally cannot hallucinate. Mm-hmm. And that is a bold statement on the LLM era, but the way I do it is, I know what came from the user message. I do like the basic cleanups of, okay, this is very obvious, it's just XML or user turn, like a salvation turn complicating, that stuff immediately gets thrown out. Mm-hmm. But the then you have the obvious, very hard problem of what is relevant.
Yeah.
I don't inject, obviously, all user messages into every turn. I inject what is relevant to what the user is saying now. And it takes a few shapes. Is the noun, if the user says, fix the database, you probably know a lot about what the database is.
Mm.
And it has been empirically proven what the database is, right? I can inject all the databases SQLite, the whatever. The schema is defined in blah, the blah, 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 you know, like all the things of what the noun is. Each noun entry is super minimal. It's usually like one paragraph, maybe. It's usually very, very, very small. I don't want to define what the, you know, all the features of the database, you know. But I give pointers too, you know, okay, there's more in these things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on one side. And then the anything that is relevant with regards to the what the task is or research how this shit works and whatever, all that, there are two things. It does like a rag that usually finds a lot of things. It's easy to re-rank and all these things. So, you know, like a vector database. So it's very easy to find a bunch. It usually has a bunch of false positives and false negatives. So it's like, you know, a good first approach. But then I grab a very fast, cheap Ollama model. And I put pretty much like the whole index of everything that is known about the project, like all the wikis. I compile wikis that are generated from LLMs, and it goes through all of them with pointers, with tools to be able to navigate the wiki. The whole point of all of this is give a very broad view to an LLM, not Codex yet. Codex, I sent a message to Codex, but Codex hasn't started executing my user message. It's waiting for the proactive context hook to finish executing.
Mm-hmm.
It gathers all these. It has tools to navigate, but the navigation always finishes in user messages.
Mm-hmm.
And all that LLM can produce is coordinates of user messages, of things the user has said or things the user has reacted to that the assistant said. And it injects, it just says coordinate blah, coordinate blah, coordinate blah, coordinate blah. So what gets injected into the thing is the nouns and actual things that the user said.
Mm-hmm.
The LLM cannot produce a story based on the text that came out. Only the coordinates with sources. So the codex, once it sees it might go...
It's pointers to past conversations. That
It's pointers to conversations that have been scoped and analyzed. So the moment it sees all that, it might understand that this bug, it immediately relates, or like whatever, like this part of the code, it's immediately related to this whole subsystem that it might have missed.
Mm-hmm.
And it typically finds nuance, which I think is like the most interesting part. A lot of times, if you have a complex project, you fix something that the agent assumed that was one way, and you fix it and you say, no, this is how it actually works. And this is, you know, typically you hint at the why. And when the agent is working on fixing a bug, it might be tempted to fix your nuance, because it doesn't understand the fucking why.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But proactive context, the whole purpose of the thing is proactive context to the moment that is happening, inject into the session, this is why this is this way.
Yeah.
Don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's why we don't have a password reset button, for example.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know, proactive context, it's kind of fascinating because then you go into the what is the... What is what is salient to this from all these texts?
Yeah, yeah. What is relevant and what should you make salient?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I run a bunch of experiments because there are like almost infinite ways of how to orchestrate things and, you know, how to weigh the different things. But I don't know. I find it as a very interesting because it's like you are kind of forcing a memory layer. But it's not like an act. It's not a memory in the way that we refer to memory typically. You know, like the Asians right now, they choose to remember something. That's obviously not how we work. We would not be here if that's how humans
We kind of don't know how it works for us in some sense, and it's also we are embodied, they are not. Our memory is highly related to our embodiment.
But we can obviously observe empirically that we don't choose to remember a thing.
Yeah,
no, the memory just forms.
We can hack our systems though. Like repetition is one part.
Repetition or trauma.
Exactly. And that's why like everyone knows, for example, smell is such a important thing for memory. Like you go back to a very old place and you suddenly all the memories flood back just because of the smell, like those kind of things.
Yeah.
And so we work, I'm just pointing that out because we work obviously very differently than all lambs.
100%. In a way that the trauma part, it is one of the things that I think have been explicitly added on top of LLMs, because if you say, no, I told you a million times not to do, recording memory.
And that's also, I liked the demo we saw this Friday of making agents suffer. And he had this little thing where it's like a Tamagotchi and it has a very, like, I think he mentioned a 4-layer neural network and it will learn how to eat food and it will over time learn to avoid the little traps that exist that hurt it and so on. And for us, memory, like, and that's what Verveke always goes on about, like, if we want actual human-like intelligence, we have to make the decision to embody agents and to make them feel pain and to have them actually die, like embodied death, real death, and to make them care about something. Like, first of all, we have to make them care about themselves, which is basically care about keeping yourself alive and so on. And also next, like after that, we have to basically, the only entities that really care about something in the grander scheme of things would be childbearing entities. And from that, you know, like it bubbles out into family, community and so on. And then it bubbles out into like more long-term things and in the end, the true, the good and the beautiful, you know, like that's, I mean, he has like, you know, 100 hours of lectures on this. but that's very compressed kind of like, if we want to have proper memory, that's what we already know from the cognitive science perspective, what we would need to do with LLMs to get there. And I talked with Kelly about the world models and so on, like LLMs are just like the first instance of something approximating intelligence and so on. And it's also worth pointing out that our memory is not about the past, it's about the future. It's about don't make the same mistake in the future.
Right, yeah, yeah. That's why trauma makes it so...
Exactly. Exactly. And if you resolve trauma, the memory also goes away.
With trauma, you have memory formation like, before the ability
to... If you actually learned the lesson, your memory will dissolve. Like, you will not remember that anymore. It's like memory is only about the future, it's not about the past.
Right.
And that's something that LLMs obviously don't have, don't get, and so on. And so we have to. I mean, OpenClaw is something that really try to do that. After every run, compress it, create the memory files, always look at the memory files, and so on. And so that was kind of the first instance. And now, of course, it's more sophisticated.
Yeah, but I think that all the sophistication, it's layers of hacks on top.
Absolutely.
So I actually saw this thing that they. I don't know when they introduced it, on Cloud Code, it can choose to terminate a session. I asked it, when do you use this tool and shit like that? And it told me that it uses the end session tool and it doesn't process any more new messages within that session. When the user is abusive or the user is harmful, you know, like the typical things. But that is replicating an emergent behavior of if I spit on your face, you don't have to be told, hey, if someone spits on your face, you should walk away or you should, you know, punch the person. It's something that emerges, right?
It's innate.
But within this model, I think that's where I went wrong with 10x is adding the behavior that you want to observe, adding explicit commands on top and on top and on top and on top, instead of focusing on solid primitives that just allow the thing to behave in to choose to behave in those directions instead of telling it, oh, end session when the user calls you an asshole, you know?
Yeah. And it also, everything is context dependent. There might be situations where spitting in the face is like something someone wants, you know?
100%.
I'm not going to get into it, but yeah. All right, that was great. I'm all out of steam.
All right.
Yeah, it's mostly the medication, but it was really good. And yeah, we'll do this again next time.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about the cohort. It's a good group of people.
I'm really. This was a very, very first week.
Yeah.
Very first week. I was very pumped.
Yeah, one of the best first weeks I think we had.
I think so. I think so too.
Great, first demo day.
We didn't even mention, but we should do an honorary mention. I think the stuff that Sandwich has been working on, it is insanely inspiring. I think it's the end goal of Nostr.
Yeah.
It's empowering this kind of thing.
Yeah.
It is naplet.run. People should check it out.
Yeah.
It is absolutely insane. It's like a different way that happens to also mesh really well with agentic development.
Yeah.
It's a different way of thinking about software development.
Yeah, and in some sense, it's related to the 10x Mosaico switch.
Yeah,
because 100%. 10x was like one big cathedral, one like let's do everything. Most Amethyst is such a thing, for example.
But Amethyst,
like those
Amethyst. I was thinking about it last night. Amethyst should be reconstructed in this shape.
And the whole naplet idea, like you can, again, I had a long conversation with Sandwich about it. If someone's interested, like
very
listen
good
to
conversation.
That.
I like it a lot.
But it's basically like let's decompose everything, and every single view, every single little element becomes an applet, like a Nostr applet. You can think about it as like widgets and so on, and it's composable, and they can intercommunicate as well. And again, it's not perfect yet, but it's very quickly getting there. And then you can throw together a client extremely quickly and just composing it of existing naplets. And Hazard showed this off, for example, just yesterday, on the demo day. He built a whole Nostr client that looks like a regular Nostr client.
It looks like a regular app.
Yeah.
It's just a website.
And the way it works, that was so cool the way he presented it, because he just showed this and then he went like,
he demoed like the most boring thing ever.
And by the way, every single view that you saw is an applet. And he built the whole engine, the whole naplet engine, which is the client. And it just, instead of opening up the naplets in a different window and so on, it just composes so that it looks like a client. But every single view, every single element of it is a naplet on itself. And that was so cool.
But if you play that out, and particularly when you contrast it with Amethyst that has everything, right? Mm. And it's very interesting because Amethyst has all these functionalities, then Substore launches. Mm. So he says, oh, I want live streams. So I'm going to implement everything that Substore has. It's not Substore, sorry, Substream.
Yeah.
Marketplace launches. Okay, I'm going to implement this. Literally now that can be possible without Bitter touching the code base. If done right, without Bitter touching the code base, every single one of these apps it's just one. It's
and
just
you can
one
make part. It easily like user configurable. Like, what do you want your Amethyst to look like, or whatever your client to look like? I want to have this module, and so on. Because now, if you open Amethyst and you open the setting screen of Amethyst, it's almost like an endless scroll. It's like a feed in and of itself, like 17 pages of configuration options and so on. It's really funny. But yeah, shout out to Vitor for the eternal kitchen sink client. You know, like it's fantastic.
This morning,
still my daily driver, by the way. I still kind of use it the most.
This morning, I started working on. You want to start going up?
I'll stay here, actually. Stay here. I'll have some food. Yeah.
This morning I started working, you know, I've been working on this NMP thing.
Yeah.
That is like a very powerful library in Rust and whatnot, that doing like all the things. And this morning I started the agents working on like a runtime that can run on an iPhone where each view, like it doesn't provide any functionality, any app, basically. Mm-hmm. Everything is naplets.
Yeah.
And the idea is, you say, for example, you run a naplet feed, and you tap on someone's profile. It in the same way that what Hazard was doing with the what he demoed yesterday, it just publishes an intent of open profile, and hopefully some other naplet exists. It has been installed in the runtime of this one user
that
navigates like navigation stack iOS style, like fully native.
Yeah.
It's just a web view, of course. Cool. But it navigates, it, like the feel.
Then you can go back. And
it just feels exactly native.
Yeah.
But you can, I don't like this profile Naplet. I'm going to change to this other profile Naplet. I know I want marketplaces. But how you compose the application is up to the user to decide. It just installs things and publishes intents.
It's funny. And it's funny that also, like, if you know something about iOS or Android development or just OS development in general, to make all this work, Sandwich had to rebuild an operating system, basically, and rebuild all this.
Yeah.
Like, intents and so on, and, like, and also, you know, notifications and, like, resource management and, like, what are the interfaces between the things and so on. And so it's a native operating system.
One part that we hinted at yesterday after his demo, that I'm going to see him today to talk about this, because I think it would be super powerful if the runtime didn't have to provide all the features. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, Blossom. Mm-hmm. It would be very cool to support Blossom without the runtime implementing Blossom or Outbox or any of these things, really.
So kind of have a core runtime and the rest is plugins in some sense, like kernel.
Like a headless Naplet that just says, what I do is I provide Outbox calculation. What I do is Blossom uploads. What I do is...
I mean, that's how kernels work, right? Like, you have a kernel, and the kernel doesn't support everything.
Exactly.
And then you need a kernel module.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the same concept can be built with just... Mm. I think it can be a Naplet, a headless Naplet, or it could be some other concept. Awesome. But I provide this service. It's a microservice architecture, basically.
Awesome. Great. Yeah, shout out Naplet. Shout out FIPS also. Like, I'm so excited about the FIPS stuff. It's really cool.
Many good things, man. Many good things.
All right, one more. I'll press stop. Let's see if this thing recorded. It might be the cable that's a little bit broken, so I hope not. I have too many cables. Because I never know which one is the good one. Ah, it looks good.